Hello and welcome to The Dementia Experience. This is our second podcast. We have a fantastic friend of mine called Rachel Cumin, who is a brilliant, brilliant musician and has been a great, great friend of my husband's in particular since they were at college together. We've crossed paths loads living in the same sort of area of England, and she's here today to talk about the power of music, the experience that she had of her own mother's Alzheimer's, and all about life and loss. Here she is. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Well, you're at home in a studio, aren't you? This is somewhere that is kind of your place.
Yep.
Tell us why that is.
So I've just left my studio at home, actually. I was working till late last night. And so, yes, I have a couple of elder children now. They're 22 and 19. And before I had got pregnant with my eldest, I lived and worked in London. I was signed to a record label called Junior Boys Own. Mm-hmm. And then halfway through my career, they then signed to V2. So essentially I was with Virgin and Junior Boys Own. And I recorded albums. I'm a singer-songwriter and a vocalist. And also I program music. So I kind of do the whole thing, really, but then kind of hand over to producers who sort of help me to kind of then co-write and you know, add sparkle to the music. So that's what I did. And when I was at college with your husband, mm-hmm. I was studying music there at Oxford Brookes. So really, I've been, yeah, a musician since I can remember, from way back.
Yeah, it's in your blood, isn't
it? It's in my blood. And now I'm sort of have brought the children up. The youngest one is about to leave home, and now I'm about to begin doing a bit of work for film again and recording a bit more. But in between all of that, I had some elderly parents and, of course, my mum, who had Alzheimer's. So, you know, I've been caring for children for 20 years and caring for parents for 10. So I've...
You really represent to me someone who... You were one of the first friends I had that was kind of involved in that ageing of their own parents whilst having their young family their own. And I really feel we are sort of stuck in the middle, aren't we? We're the sort of
sandwich.
Jam in the middle of that sandwich, just kind of struggling with both younger kids and then the ageing parents that we have. Mm. So your darling mum, Audrey, she had dementia and she stayed at home throughout her dementia kind of journey.
Yeah.
And how did you plug into her? How did you find ways to really connect with her?
Music. I mean, you know, hence the reason we're talking today. It's the most, you know, it's awful to watch. And all those, you know, sayings about you lose them twice are so true. Mm. So I noticed, she was diagnosed in 2015, but I had noticed a long time before, years before, that something was up. There was like a kind of a glitch or a kind of a stuck record. And I tried to sort of reach out to people around me who I think were too afraid to face the fact that this was happening.
Yeah.
But being a mum and a woman, you know, I just thought, no, we need to kind of address this. And then eventually in 2015, she had her diagnosis, which was Alzheimer's. Mm. And from that moment on, my brother got very poorly afterwards, and I lost them both in the same year, my mum and my brother. And then my father was a painter, so he was fully working until the last week of his life. So it was full on. Mm. And the only person really that could step in was me to take care of Audrey.
Yeah.
But yeah, the kids were, you know, so young, but I feel that I neglected them in some respects because I just couldn't be in all these places at once. Yeah. Although as a mum, you feel like you can take on, you know, the universe because you are there in the capacity of being a carer and, a, you know, but it was so difficult. And and as mum slipped away more and more mentally, I found, you know, and she was so scared. You can see that they are vulnerable and needing to feel assured. And music for me, I mean, I just, you know, so many memories of just driving in the car and singing with her. You know, all of my music taste comes from my mum, who was a big music fan and listened to all these greats, and these are all the influences I grew up with.
Yeah. What does she love? What were her favourites?
She loved J.J. Cale, the Beatles, The Sound of Bread. Do you know that?
No.
I think they're called Bread. Mm. So I remember she was she collapsed, and in the last year of her life, she was laid up in bed, basically a hospital bed, which I managed to keep her at home. And I have this memory of her. It was almost like she had a locked-in sort of syndrome. She couldn't really comprehend or vocalise anything. Mm. And, I mean, this is the very end. And I just remember singing to her. Mm. So, Bread, you would know them. They sang, "Hey, have you ever tried really reaching out?" You know, and I just, and her expressions on her face, you know, this sort of connection. Mm. You know, she couldn't speak to me. We were all talking to her so much, but she couldn't vocalise her emotions back again. But when I sang to her, you know, just the expressions in her face were incredible. So I knew that I was reaching out to her. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so true, isn't it? Like, it's when words stop being accessible, and suddenly, the music touches the parts that nothing else does. Yeah. Yeah. And seeing the change in her face, how extraordinary.
It is. I mean, I think, you know, you're terrified for them. So it's about making an environment that feels safe and trustworthy. And because, you know, nothing kind of makes sense anymore. And so to, you know, and that mum, you know, there was, with Alzheimer's came a lot of anger and denial and frustration. And, you know, I've seen other people with dementia who are having a better experience and just seem quite chilled, really. But Audrey, there was a lot of fear. And so just these expressions on her face, you know, this kind of and a childlike awe, you know, that something was making connection with her. And,
And
amazing.
It is soothing as well. Like you say, you know, you were probably tapping into your own maternal instincts with your mum, and knowing that a lullaby for a baby when they're crying works a treat sometimes, and not always, but can, you know, really sort of be quite magical.
It is magical. And the kids would come in as well, you know, and we'd sit there and sing in harmony. Didn't really know what else to do. Yeah. We were just, you know, it was just a long, awful journey, and this was the kind of last bit of it, really, where we just all kind of sat together and just kind of sang like the Von Trapp family.
brilliant. But it is what makes sense, and you do go to those places that just are instinctive, that you're not using your brain power any longer. And you're right, when fear takes over, which it does throughout the journey, doesn't it? Did you feel that you had to learn quite a lot very, very quickly about Alzheimer's, about human rapport, relationships, working with the carers? How was all of that? Was it a steep, steep learning curve?
I had an amazing geriatrician, Elena Mucci, who is based in Hastings. And she has a podcast, not a podcast, but she has I think she's on Instagram, and she's really worth watching. I think she feels quite angered, actually, by the state of the service, you know, not the particularly the people that are working in those services, but just things, how things are being run in this country at the moment. And so it was very difficult. I was just speaking to somebody about this today. You know, we were constantly being assessed. Mm-hmm. We were having to, that was exhausting, trying to kind of find a way around me being able to be with my mum, but also having to stretch the truth a bit to enable help to come in. You know, if I'd proclaimed that I was there every day, then I'm sure that the services would have been stopped. And it makes me cross to think that I had to pretend that I was away all the time to enable that help. And so it's really difficult because you're navigating carers, you're navigating, like you said earlier, children, my parents, my father was still alive, my brother was ill. And you're on the back foot all the time because you're trying to, navigate and understand what is happening to this person that you love so much and who is turning into a child and reverting back to, you know, and becoming, and they're raw, you know, this sort of, you just, oh, it was just awful. I just had to sort of embrace her and keep her safe. And that was my natural instinct.
Was
to just step right in and just kind of try and make everything as smooth as possible and the journey as smooth as possible, which I think I managed to do, but it was pretty tough.
Yeah. And it is a full-time job, as you say. Your heartstrings are being pulled because it's such an emotional roller coaster. But then you are learning about all these systems that you've never even heard of before.
Yeah. And also, I think that I didn't realise at the time, but, you know, I think the children were so affected by it because they're not only seeing the person that they love, their grandmother, and they were so close, you know. You know, they came into their own. They became such amazing little adults, which was sad for children so young in some respects. But they really kind of helped out. But also they were watching their own mum, i.e. me, you know, just be... I was so distracted and my attention was turned away from them, but they kind of got, you know, pulled all their strength together to sort of support me as well. And it's just the sort of the strains.
Yeah.
And you're trying so hard to be in the middle of all this, to try and just keep everything balanced.
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
What helped you? How did you recharge your batteries? How did you stay so strong?
I have no idea. I mean, a few people have said to me, we just watched you come into your own at that point. You just suddenly found, I mean, I just took every day as it came. And it was love, pure love of my mum and dad who'd done so much for me.
Yeah.
To just want them to have this wonderful end of life journey, essentially.
Yeah.
And
so it brought out the best in you.
It really did. And I didn't run away. I just had to face it head on. So what helped me? I mean, music.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
You know.
Would you just play it loud?
Yeah, play it loud. But also just going off and doing a little bit of music myself here and there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not as much as I used to, but enough to kind of now be, you know, back in touch with my old producer and saying, look, this is what I did during my journey, which he's finding quite mind-blowing, actually.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
How else did I manage? My amazing husband. And, you know, we come from a really creative family. I just could see that my dad needed to carry on working as well. Well, you just do, don't you? You're a mum. Mm-hmm. You're in that role already. You're already doing school runs and after school clubs and just generally being a whole myriad of various roles that you just take on another one. I mean, I have no idea, but I think also I wanted very much to look back. I could see the future and I wanted to look back and know that there would have been no regrets and that in every single way Mum was comfortable and she was well cared for and that I had the best time with her at the end. I would have never forgiven myself if I looked back and just thought, oh, no, I should have done that differently.
So you almost went to your max because you could see the future and you just dreaded the idea of regret.
Yeah,
you had to give it your all.
Yeah, exactly. And to know that they were well cared for. But, you know, I mean, along the way, I was taught how to use hoists. I was taught how to turn her. I was taught how to wash her. I mean, I was deeply, deeply involved. I had to be because... unfortunately, some of the care just wasn't there. And so I had to step into that role. So it became, you know, very personal. I just don't know where I found that strength to do that. But I'm so glad I did because I could monitor everything. And I knew she was, you know, clean and cared for and comfortable and safe.
Yeah.
And she was like a baby at the end. So, it's really tough.
Yeah.
And the journey before that, up until that last kind of year, you know, it was really special. I have amazing memories of just driving in the car with her and singing and her trying to kind of speak to me and communicate with me. And, you know, I remember one time her holding my hand and saying, I, you know, she was trying to tell me that she loved me.
Yes.
And I just put my hand on her and said, I know you love me and it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, so... Oh, it's such an emotional roller coaster, and yeah, music. She loved music. Leonard Cohen, and you know, she lifted her heart, and so just singing along with her. And isn't it extraordinary that when somebody can't speak, like when she was saying, "I love, love, love," you know, if I put a song on, she would just sing word for word in tune.
Yes.
Is that the same with your mum?
Well, it can be. Yeah, not necessarily in tune. Less talent, I think. But yeah, yeah, certainly those words, yeah, the lyrics are deeply ingrained. It's nuts. It is nuts.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah. I mean, what is it do you think it is from child, from being a baby?
And I think that somehow or other, music is sort of imprinted in the body and bypasses the brain. It doesn't necessarily need the brain to have the kind of ability to feel it or produce it.
Yeah.
So if the brain is, I don't, this is just
a muscle memory.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just deeply in there. And I find with my mum that once we've had a gorgeous sing song or a big cry to a brilliant song from, you know, a wedding or whatever that really triggered lots of goodies in her, the imprint stays, you know, for the rest of the day almost.
Yeah.
It's not just in that moment. Yeah. It kind of lasts a bit longer, which is lush.
And lifts her spirit.
Really lifts. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's quite incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked a bit about the kind of fear that we all have, whether it's to do with watching our parents age or coming across a situation like Alzheimer's dementia and knowing that this is a whole new world for us and we've no idea how it works, and it's all quite terrifying because it's so raw and distressing. But we also talk, you know, about just aging and dying generally as something that we all feel quite worried about. You know, when we look at the East, for example, I've got a wonderful friend from Sri Lanka. There isn't this fear. Like, why is that? Why is there so much more of an embrace and almost a celebration of the aging process? You know, why do we kind of, is there something kind of Western about it? Or is it because we don't talk enough about aging? You know, is dementia extreme aging, basically? And therefore, we're extremely terrified of talking about it because it's too depressing. And yet we know that if they're like little children towards the end, that surely is glorious. Surely that is worth celebrating.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I think that as a society, we are more fragmented. I was speaking to somebody just before I came in here today about the fact that a lot of carers would come, and I mean, there was a lot of turnover of care. But mostly everybody that came to us said, this is a really lovely family to work for.
Yeah.
There's so much love here.
Yeah.
I wonder whether we're unusual in that respect. And so when you talk about, you know, culturally as in the West, everyone's so busy.
Yeah.
We're under so much strain. I mean, I was fortunate enough to have a wonderful husband who allowed me to turn my attention to my parents and my brother at the same time. But, you know, and he very much took up the slack with the kids. Yeah. So he was a huge support. Yeah. But I wonder whether we're lucky in that respect, and that there are a lot of people who are holding down a job and have children and parents that live further away and are struggling to... there's no community there. And it's no fault of their own. It's just the way that everybody's on a kind of a treadmill, and there are better communities in other parts of the world, maybe. I mean, even just going to Italy, you know, and the climate, and everybody's just kind of outside, and the old people are sitting outside kind of talking. you know, we kind of shut our elderly away a little bit, don't we, in this country? And there's quite a lot of loneliness.
Yeah. And those that are shut away, perhaps even like my mum in a care home, you know, the key I've found to my own sort of ability to survive this stage is to bring life to her.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you're there all the time.
And just not necessarily just me physically, but bringing in a community, bringing in a choir or whoever it is, just to kind of, make sure that the links are carried on, that it's not just a lock up and go.
Yeah.
And the same with the elderly at home is getting them, either bringing life to them or getting them to the community centres, et cetera, to connect with others.
Well, exactly. I mean, I had to keep Mum at home because it was such an awful situation, because I was losing my brother at the same time, and Fred needed to work and he needed his family around him. So I was very much enabling that to happen. In my situation, there were times when I had to put Mum into respite care because we were either going for, you know, there was a situation happening, there was a changeover of care, I wasn't available or something. So a couple of times we did. And she was perfectly fine and their care home was absolutely wonderful. And like you said, she would absolutely love the choir coming in or the flower kind of arranging, you know, or something going on. Yeah. And they were wonderful activities. So they absolutely worked so hard to make that happen. But I needed her to be home. That was my particular sort of circumstance. I needed to be on board all the time. And like I said, I was losing Danny at the same time. So I just needed to have them create that family for as long as possible, really.
Yeah. And it's about sort of keeping the control as well, isn't it?
Well,
you need to be able to know what's happening. And as you say, you were losing so much.
Yeah.
It must have felt like sand sort of slipping through your fingers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, well, you are extraordinary, extraordinary. And I'm really hopeful that, just the discussions like this will continue to delete the stigma, you know, that is attached to not only aging generally, but also to those, you know, who are aging in this extreme way, in this, you know, really sort of tragic way.
Yeah.
And within those tragic situations, there are these extraordinary moments, like you said, with your mum telling you that she loved you and you just squeezing her hand and having all of that, but underpinned with glorious music or whatever the glorious thing is that does bond you with your loved one. For some, it can be other things, can't it? It can be, you know, painting or sitting in the garden or looking at the birds or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
All of those things.
And I think, in my case, I needed to keep it. Also, not just for me, I needed to keep it a happy kind of memory for Fred, for my dad as well. It very much was so important for everything was shattering to pieces when Audrey got Alzheimer's. So, you know, I kind of really stepped into that mum role and wanted everybody to have a good experience. I mean, it's extraordinary how, I don't know how I managed to just keep everything kind of afloat, and I haven't had a breakdown since.
Yeah.
So I haven't kind of come out of it going, whoa, you know, I've come out of it saying, well, you know, these things are, people can do this.
Yeah.
It is manageable and there are services out there and you do need to kind of tap into those and not be afraid to ask for help and, you know, or that you aren't managing, you're not managing and hope to get, you know, some sort of help on board. It's a horrible disease, but there can be magical moments and,
Well, you did a brilliant, brilliant job. How did Fred cope? Do you think he needed you, definitely?
He needed me. He needed Audrey around. He needed Danny around. He needed to, you know, he needed to carry on working himself. He was led by me. It was so strange because I was the baby in the family. I mean, I was 7 years younger than Danny, 30 and 40 years younger than Mum and Dad. They had me, you know, later on. But suddenly I was kind of like, you know, promoted to the kind of head of the family.
Yeah.
And Dad, you know, it was a very special, and I felt very honoured to have Dad kind of taking my lead a little bit, this kind of person that I'd looked up to all my life, you know, me kind of saying it's going to be okay and smoothing the way for everybody as much as I possibly could.
So an intense role reversal of you sort of changing your position in the hierarchy and them looking to you for that reassurance for that constantly.
It's quite strange, isn't it, being a kind of a mum in the middle of all of this. Having said that, my husband then, a year ago, lost both of his parents to dementia, and they both died 2 weeks apart. And, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of dementia and Alzheimer's in the family, but he was extraordinary as well. And, you know, I mean, they were a bit further away. They were an hour away, but we managed to be there every week. You know, they didn't get to the point with my mum, as with my mum, who, you know, as I said, was, you know, laid up in bed for a year. But, you know, boys also, I mean, I'm sounding so sexist here, going, women and mums are great. But he was fantastic, him and his brother. So,
So people do step up.
They do
time
step up.
Of crisis.
Yeah. Well, that's right. It's quite strange, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And in a way, having both of us and now, and also your husband as well, Lewis as well, you know, you kind of see a totally different side of them because they've had to step up.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I feel quite grateful in a way that I've seen my true colours, that often you have to wait till the very end of your life to know who you really are. Whereas I've sort
We've
of,
done it in our kind of late 40s.
Yeah. It's like all of these qualities that I had not, even my mother-in-law's like, flipping heck, I didn't know Clara was kind. I'm like, no, I haven't changed my personality, but I can do kind things occasionally. But yeah, you're sort of, your own mask drops a bit as well, because you're in your rawest state as a carer, as someone who's holding the fort, keeping things going with the kids, etc. So maybe it is an advantage to have those true colours revealed.
Yeah, I think so. You learn a lot about yourself. You become, you know, I mean, and I remember saying to somebody, I feel like I haven't got any skin. I feel like I'm absolutely raw and everybody can see inside me. There's so much going on and but I don't know what to do apart from to just keep going forwards. And people, friends came to the fore and absolutely helped out at that point because they can see that you're just juggling everything. Like I said a moment ago, you should never feel like you can't ask for some help.
Yeah. And people are grateful
and
to be involved.
Grateful.
They want to help. Yeah, they want to be able to play their part.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. You sort of suddenly have all these kind of strings to your bow and you just think, well, I don't know where I'm getting this from, this sort of energy and strength. And
So there's much more to us as human beings than we think. And it's only when we're seriously under pressure that our true colours come to the sort of surface.
Yeah.
And maybe that sort of pressure is good for us occasionally so that we're not cruising in any way, just, you know, doing our thing, when actually, this has pushed us because it's so raw. I like the idea that you said you kind of felt exposed, that you had no skin because you were so real, perhaps, and bursting into tears in front of people that you'd never met and all those things that perhaps you might have covered up before.
Yeah.
You can't control all of that. So you are, you are truly yourself in these times.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. Did you feel like your friends could read the situation, that they were able to know that you needed them?
Absolutely. And I have another friend who said, you know, as a society, we ought to talk about death a bit more. We're so afraid of talking about death. And after Mum passed away, and I've talked so much about it, and I could tell the people that really couldn't cope with it and would remove themselves from the situation and change the subject. And there were some that would embrace it and allow me to talk. And so it was quite interesting that this friend did come forward and say, you know, we need to, as an aging population with illnesses, you know, and it's inevitable, it's all going to happen to us. And that we are having to step in a bit more due to whatever reasons that, you know, our services have been underfunded and what have you. And so, you know, family members are having to step in. We need to, we all know that it's coming to us and to not be afraid of that. And it's, it wasn't till after Mum had passed away that I, you know, now I'm kind of, it's just, I don't know. It's just an interesting, I'm so happy to be able to help and talk to you and help other people.
And you're right. The more we discuss it, the better, in the sense that we're opening up those conversations. But also, even I heard Gabby Roslin speaking on the radio the other day. She was talking, you know, saying we are all going to live longer. So we've got to lay foundations now in our midlife, which is, you know, in our 40s, 50s, like, not just deny that old age is coming, not keep living as if we're 20, like, you know, clubbing and da-da-da, get our kicks elsewhere. Yeah. Obviously, we don't have to become boring or start taking up golf or anything hilarious. although I'm quite tempted. No, but we can still be ourselves. We can still be youthful in our spirit, but we have to lay foundations so that those old age years, which could be 70, 80, 90, 100 years old, that's a long time. We don't want to be just sat watching Countdown. We need to make sure we're in our best tip-top condition.
It's quite interesting because Lewis, my husband, his sister-in-law, her parents live in New Zealand. You know, they are in these amazing communities. Mm. They kind of moved themselves there earlier on. You know, where they have this fantasy, you know, and I thought we need to have more things like that here. Mm. These amazing communities where we're not afraid to, you know, my parents didn't, they couldn't downsize because Fred needed to be at home. He needed the studio. But there were times when I thought it would be so much easier now if you were kind of, you know, in a wonderful community that was cared for, where you know, Lewis's sister-in-law, she sort of, the parents go and play cards or they go bowling or they have a cinema club or... I don't know whether those sorts of... We need more of that, really, in, you know, and to... I don't know what it is about our culture where we just kind of keep going until we suddenly face old age and then it sort of terrifies us. And, we're not prepared at all.
And we should insist on building those communities. I used to think it was quite sort of tragic. You know, the people that were doing cake sales and stuff. I was like, oh, God, get a life. But that was, you know, in my 20s and stuff. But then now I'm like, I want to roll my sleeves up because you get the kicks and you get the connections. Yeah. And you can't just bring up kids on your own. Yeah. And you can't look after an old person on your own. Yeah. You can't be an old person on your own. You need, the kind of, you know, that brilliant Indian Marigold Hotel sort of scenario. And we all want to share one massive house together when we're in our 70s, you know.
How many times have we talked about this?
Like, that is the dream. If we're not together, then there's just no point in continuing. You know, we need to be able to tap into each other. No man's an island, and we can't just live solitary lives. You know, we do have to share.
Well, I think that's the most worrying thing, isn't it? It's the fear of loneliness.
Yeah.
That's the most worrying thing, and I think that's why I needed to be with Mum all the time, just to make sure that she, you know, knew that she wasn't alone, and and maybe music, you know, brought that to her as well. It's interesting
because I found with Mum the other day we had two opera singers come to her care home, and she was electric. She was the white Tina Turner as these extraordinary singers performed, and she refused to sit down. And she
this was, is your mum,
she was right up in everyone's grill, just telling them to sort it out. And most of the poor other residents are in wheelchairs, so you know they can sing along, but they can't do much more than that. Yeah. And she was like, get up and enjoy this. But she definitely, you know, came alive with that. But she's got community within that care home.
Yeah.
But also, it was the connections that were being made in her, not in her brain, but in her soul.
Yeah.
So I definitely think that, it does reach the part, you know, like that awful beer advert of like only reaching the part that nothing else does or whatever it is. Like, music does just touch the point. Mm. And within all of them, like, regardless of what point they were at in their sort of Alzheimer's or dementia, there was an aliveness, definitely. And I think, we know that it just, it joins the dots. It's an immediate party. Like, as far as Mum was concerned, this was her 21st.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was on the meet and greet. People that she'd never seen before. She couldn't stop thanking for coming. You know, like she was the ambassador's wife. You know, she was back in that world.
Yeah.
And it's thanks to the music that, you know, that was the way of getting her there.
Is she what I found when Mum went in on her respite days was that she was very much more able and agile and and lively, even though she was quite far down the road of Alzheimer's.
Yes.
You know, I think that that's quite interesting as well. I see so much of your mum in my mum, where they've had a really, you know, they're in, they've been interesting people, and they're very, you know, they have a real spirit to them. And that was Audrey all over as well.
But that's something else that we've got to lay down in middle age to keep the spirit alive, because we, you know, say we were with dementia or Alzheimer's later, we sure don't want to be going down without a fight. We want to keep that vibe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's important, isn't it, to keep electric, regardless of the decade that we're in.
Well, yeah, exactly. And for me personally, it's keeping, you know, going back to me, you know, I'm 53, I'm kind of no longer in that pop music bracket anymore, but music is so important to me. That's my, it's my interest, and I have to, it's quite good that I've kind of got people kind of shaking me on the outside, you know, on the outskirts now, sort of saying, come on, you've got to get back to it, get back on with your music, because that's the thing that kind of keeps you going. And I'm terrified of Alzheimer's. I'm terrified of early onset dementia. I'm, you know, it's scary, isn't it, when you've seen that happen to your to your, one of your parents, one of the people that you love, you know, somebody you come from.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, oh, my goodness. So I've got to keep that going, that kind of love of music, or my passion for the thing that I love doing.
Yeah, because that charges your batteries.
Yeah, it is. It does.
And it means that even if you did get dementia, you know that the life that you've led has been 100%.
Yeah.
And there's no regret, as you said earlier, that you're kind of doing what makes you tick.
Exactly. And do you worry about it?
I think about Alzheimer's quite a bit. I think, well, you know, if Mum's had it, and, you know, it's likely, or, you know, it could well come my way. And I've seen it in, good, bad and ugly. But, it's because I think I'm now doing exactly what I want to be doing. It feels like I'm in exactly the right place. I now just think, no more excuses. Like, I might well have been fearful about changing careers in the past, or making big changes, but now I just think, stuff it. I've even booked a holiday with Stanley to Mallorca, and we don't even, like, we find it tricky hanging out for 10 minutes, let alone for a full holiday, all-inclusive, Chav Central. He wants me to go for it. So I'm like, well, okay, I will.
We're off.
So all or nothing. All or nothing from now on.
But are you feeling like, I mean, I'm a few years, quite a few years ahead of you, but are you feeling like I did in the middle of everything with Audrey, which is just like, where am I finding this kind of momentum?
I was, when Mum was still in London and I was still working full time as a teacher down in Dover, I felt really stretched. And Stan, our son, who's 12 now, but was sort of 10, 11 at the time, he was in the centre of all of it. And I just, there wasn't enough of me, exactly as you said. You feel totally stretched, and nothing's ever good enough. And then now I've got her under my wing, as it were, under the umbrella of Woodchurch, the village where we live. She's in the care home there. So I'm kind of managing it, but at arm's length, so there's still energy for me, there's still enough for Stan. Family life can continue. It's not the sort of hardcore of her at home with me, but it couldn't have worked like that because she was so naughty.
Well, and you're lucky because you have the care home, and it's a good one, and it's in the village.
Exactly. Yeah. And now I think, flip, every village needs a care home, you know, just like they have a primary school and a pub, they need a care home as well. So everyone puts in and gets out what they put in.
Well, exactly. And we've still, and we've got a community based around the elderly people, which we are all going to become. It's kind of scary, isn't it, to think, well, we're heading that way, but there are no services set up particularly, or it's an awful lot of money, or
but it doesn't have to cost money. Like, all those lovely old people in the care home used to go and read at the primary school, so I'm getting the primary school kids now to go read to the elderly. We're going to do a swapsie, because it's like, that surely is a natural, and it doesn't cost any money, it doesn't take any energy, it's just a quick transaction that will leave a glorious impression on each of the elderly, who are so excited that little ones are coming in. And I think, and but that I can only set up because I'm in the hood.
Yeah, exactly.
So So if there are more care homes like that, that are also quite open to things happening, you know, often they stick to their rule books and they might feel like you're treading on their toes, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas we've been really lucky that the care home have got open doors and it's green light all the way, you know, in terms of bringing new stuff in.
How nice. And also how lovely that, I mean, you know, that it's music and children. Audrey couldn't have lived without having, I mean, she was lucky to have grandchildren, but to have young people around is so vital.
Yes.
And how's Stanley finding? Is Stanley finding?
Tricky, definitely tricky. Yeah. But again, yeah, I think I sometimes pretend that, like, I found a bracelet in his bedroom, which he'd probably nicked off for a year, 11 girl or something. And I took it to Mum, his granny, and I said, "This is from Stanley." And she cried with joy. So, like, the love they have for each other is sort of now, it's powerful, but he finds it tricky to face going in. He finds it tricky, not necessarily to see granny, but to see the other residents, I think he finds quite scary.
Yeah.
But he's become much more emotionally intelligent because of this whole process.
Right.
And he's seen me cry, you know, and find things really tough. And that's good. That's healthy. Yeah. Better out than in.
God, I'm so glad you said that because, I imagine that there are a lot of people that try to kind of hide that from their children. And I have looked back and thought, well, there were some things that they shouldn't have seen. But like you said, it's real.
Yeah.
They've seen me broken down and, you know, and that comes from a place of love.
Yes.
You know, not from anything else.
Yes.
It's just trying your hardest to try and kind of keep things rolling and keep everybody safe and happy. And so it's, you know, I don't regret now the lessons that they've learned. They very much are kind of now they're 22 and 19, they're just kind of see ya.
Yeah.
Right, we're on our way.
Yeah. But they're well equipped.
And they're well equipped in their own lives.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting journey, isn't it? From, like you said at the very beginning, we're sandwiched in the middle. In the middle, we're trying to deal with thinking about these young people, these vulnerable young minds, and then these elderly vulnerable people as well. And you're just kind of juggling, aren't you? You're trying to.
Yeah. But I think the role model is the jam in the middle. If the role model can sob openly and, you know, honestly, and also, juggle, but with, you know, great ability. Yeah. And as you say, we have come into our own as mums and as daughters.
Yep.
So hurrah for that. No more can we do.
And also, I just think, you know, my parents didn't do that for me. I don't remember, you know, when my grandfather died, I wasn't invited to the funeral. I was kept away from it all.
Yeah.
You know, I just, and I knew at a very young age, at 6 years old, that something was happening. I wasn't stupid.
Yeah.
You know, so it felt like I was being locked out of something. And I think that we as parents and our generation are now beginning to make it inclusive with our children because we know that they're not stupid and we know that it's important to be emotional in front of them. So, it's fascinating.
Brilliant. Rachel, you've been such a delight. Thank you so much.
You.
All of your joy, all of your wisdom, all of your strength. See you soon.